Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Laurie Anderson. Anderson is an internationally known performance artist, musician, and poet. She has released almost a dozen CDs and was appointed the first artist in residence for NASA in 2003. Her performance piece, End of the Moon, which she will perform at Ithaca State Theater on January 21st, is a result of her experience at NASA. I'm speaking to her by phone from the Bahamas. Welcome to the show, Laurie Anderson. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listen, before we talk about the end of the moon, I'd like to ask you about your writing and when it began. Were you always jotting things down and keeping diaries as a child?
Well, I was since about maybe 12. Although I haven't ever gone back and read that stuff. I have it, but I've never gotten up the nerve to actually see what I was thinking about at 12.
Was it poetry, do you think, or was it just angst?
You know, Jane said something to Bill. I don't know. When I went to Chicago recently, I realized that it was a city that I had learned when I was around 12, and so I know it the way a 12-year-old would. I mean, I know where the, like, really good candy stores are and where the, you know, disappearing ink and plastic dog poop and But I've always written stuff, and this was in at the end of the moon. In all many ways, is a mixture of, like, half, let's say, I would call it journalism, really, and the other half more sort of, well, maybe like free association stuff.
When do you remember when you started thinking in terms of combining writing with music and performance?
Yeah, it was mostly when I was making films, and I was in little, we would have these little film festivals, and by film festival I mean like six people in a loft, you know, and I was never really finished with the film in time, so I would bring my violin and stand in front of the film and do the music and the dialogue, and I thought this was a kind of interesting way for live music to work with another kind of image making, so that in many ways I've done similar things since then.
And when you're getting ready to compile a CD, say, does the music come first or do the words?
Well, I'm doing that right now and I can never remember how to do it. I'm just going to make a record, and then I think, how do you make a record? How do you do that? In this case, I've been playing with some throat singers from Mongolia. Some amazing musicians. Throat singing is that technique where you sing like the fundamental sort of a groan, and then out of that comes these beautiful harmonics. So it's almost like one person can be making about six sounds, like with these very beautiful whistling melodies, very, very high. I liked working with these guys mostly because of their string playing, and there's a lot of, I've been doing a lot of violin playing lately, so it's that really drew me to them. But in that case, I guess I'm starting with, I suppose, the music.
And then you fill in the words to fit the music.
Maybe it will have a different relationship this time, the music and the lyrics. I kind of hope so, because I'd like to experiment with some other ways of doing that.
I want to play an excerpt from your CD, Life on a String. This piece is called Pieces and Parts.
They say that in 1842, on a plantation in Alabama, the slaves unearthed a huge skeleton, the bones of a giant whale, a leviathan, from the time when all the world was covered with water, from the Andes to the Himalayas, and even Alabama was deep down under. And the slaves looked at the huge bones, and they said, "These must be the bones of a fallen angel. These must be the bones of a fallen angel."
Where did you come up with that amazing imagery? It feels like a dream to me.
You know, that's kind of an image from Moby Dick, and this is from one of the very few songs that sort of survived from that. That was a kind of multimedia production that I did based on Melville's novel Moby Dick. And I found that that book is stuffed with songs. You know, it's like it's just a song machine. If anybody, if you need any ideas for songs, that's a place to go.
Yeah, that's a beautiful song. It absolutely captured me, I must say. Let's talk about the fact that you were the first artist in residence at NASA. What was that about?
A call that came out of the blue, you know, and they just said, hi, we're from NASA. And I said, you know, I mean, I didn't believe them. I thought, yeah, you're not from NASA. Why should I believe that? That's crazy, you know. And we'd like you to be this artist in residence. And I just thought that was, you know, thought it was a joke. And it took a couple more calls to realize that they were really serious. And I think that when they asked me originally, I think that they had in mind that I would do some kind of sexy techno project, you know, like bounce light off one satellite onto another, onto the dark side of the moon sort of thing.
Really? Oh.
But, you know, so when I told them that I was going to do a long poem, their faces sort of fell. They were like, a poem? Like, why would you do a poem? Insane. So anyway, I said, you know, because it's a big topic, you know, and so on. But anyway, by the time they finished it, I did do this in Washington, and they decided it was fine. So anyway.
So you actually did the end of the moon? Did you do it in pieces, or did you have a whole project together for them to see?
Well, I also am giving them a bunch of other things, photographs and other little things that were made along the way.
Mm-hmm. But the stipulation was you did have to come up with kind of a term paper, huh, from this project?
Well, I don't think they really cared what I made, but that's how it ended up.
Mm-hmm.
When I think journalism, I mean that I really just wanted to try to describe things the way they really were, not, you know, not the way I hoped they would be or what I thought they thought I should see or, you know, other things like that. And that was really very difficult, but also NASA is it's hard to make any generalizations about it. It's such an enormous thing and made up of so many parts.
Mm-hmm.
Of, like, working with, you know, all sorts of different kinds of research institutions and universities and the military and all of that. And I think they showed me a lot of stuff, but probably nothing that I didn't see anything that they, of course, didn't want me to see.
Of course. Mm-hmm. The End of the Moon is the second part in what is finally going to be a trilogy. The first piece was called Happiness. What sets the two pieces apart? Are they a continuation?
Well, I think they're about, in a way, expectation. Happiness was, the idea was to try to put myself in various situations and see what would happen, just because I felt that I was looking at the world with a lot of sort of ideas of how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
What if I don't really know what to do? So I took a lot of really, really sort of strange jobs. I went to work on an Amish farm for a while, and I worked in McDonald's. And, and I just tried to find out what I and other people meant by that word, happiness. And In The End of the Moon, also had something to do with expectation, in the sense that I think that if you look at how Americans perceive space, it really is much more, let's say, future-oriented. You know, they don't really talk so much about the vast and enormous place that we come from with its unfathomable age and history. We talk about the future and, you know, how long it's going to take to get to Mars and what it's going to be like to live on other planets and stuff like that. So I think that you can see how people feel about the future by looking at how they feel about space.
So did you find happiness when you were researching that?
I find happiness in a lot of different things. I find silliness too. So, I don't know. It's not my goal really to find happiness. It's much more that I want to just see how things work, really. And I suppose that makes me happy, so I guess I am looking for happiness along the way.
I would think most of us are in some ways, although we don't name it. You know, I've heard various things about what the general theme of the end of the moon is. I've heard that it's about time, or about aesthetics, or about spirituality, or about consumerism. Tell us, in general, what you think it's about.
Well, somebody wrote me a long letter saying, I love that work that you did about smell. And then I looked through, you know, a little word search of, like, the text for it, and it seems to be, there's quite a bit about that in it. And so it starts from looking at in a very, very practical way, I suppose, or a very flat-footed way, at various NASA installations. So I went to, since there never was an artist in residence at NASA, I thought, you know, there was no way to find out what you were supposed to do. So I basically went around to all these different NASA places and just looked around. So from that point of view, it's about what I saw at Mission Control, at Hubble Space Telescope, at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and just sort of, you know, talking about what, of course, it's not that simple, just because, in a way, even if you go to Hubble and start talking about those images that they're on, the, on their website, for example, of what things look like in outer space, that was where I had a lot of trouble, just because some of the ways that they were using color just seemed really crazy. You know, that they're, we're not really actually getting pictures from outer space, we're getting numbers. And so we have to then turn them into pictures. So what colors are we going to use? Well, you have to kind of make them up, and they had made up colors that were looked like, you know, kind of like Walt Disney in a way.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, yeah.
Yeah. How come you're using those colors? And this conversation went on for a long time, and finally they said, you know, they said, well, we thought people would like them. And I was like, wow. I'm the one they call the artist in residence here, you know. I mean, because, you know, I found out a strange thing, which was that, in a way, scientists have a lot more in common with artists than I thought, because I think they don't know what they're looking for either. And they kind of, you kind of get a hunch, and then you try to keep your eyes open. But you always are looking with some idea of what you're going to be finding. Always with some sort of, you know, preconceived idea. So I talked to some of the nanotechnologists about this a lot, because Einstein actually had rejected some of his major theories. Why? Because he said they weren't beautiful. And I thought, wait a second, they're not beautiful. What is he looking for then? I mean, you know, so it was, I found really fascinating to see what made things supposedly true. You know, where, how do you know that you found it? What tells you when you're out there on the frontier of figuring out what colors the stars are when they're born, and how do you know when you found, really found it? So, anyway, some of the conversations were like that, although a lot of the people were not that talkative at NASA, and I think, I mean, I didn't take that personally, because it was more like, they were like just really super busy.
Well, I would think that the fact that we don't know what's out there and don't know what things are is why we have created art. Would you say?
I think partly. I think it's partly why we've created religion too. Some of the biggest mysteries in the world are our time. A lot of religions discuss that and explain it: where we come from, how we got here, where we're going to go at the end of time, you know. So I think it's one of the ways that people try to, you know,
make sense, maybe.
That art, yeah, explains some things and makes others even bigger mysteries, which I'm really interested in, especially.
Do you know yet what your third piece for this trilogy is going to be?
I'm kind of sorry I said trilogy. For one reason, it sounds really, really literary, and I'm not so much like that, but I guess I just wanted to encourage myself to make another thing, you know? So before I do that, I'm going to do some... I think I'm going to do this record before I do that. The third part. So was he. I don't know.
But you also said that you want to collect the three pieces into an epic poem. Have you decided to scrap that as well?
No. I still have that grand ambition. But I'm just taking a little break from that much language. I mean, there's a lot of music in The End of the Moon, but it's subordinate to the story. Because, you know, when I was working on it, I thought, why isn't this working? And then I realized there was a struggle between the music and the story, and I thought, something has to be first. And so I approached it more like a movie, really. And so the music is a little bit more like a soundtrack. Once in a while, it jumps up out of the story, but mostly it helps tell the story. So there's music throughout the whole piece, but it's more like keeping beats and like to move the story along. And then once in a while, play the violin, which is really fun for me because it's sort of like the most emotional part of the work. So there are a few times when there's just music. Plus, it's not a visual piece either, so I've missed like making images. So luckily, I've called myself a multimedia artist, so you can kind of do whatever you want, really.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Laurie Anderson. Listen, I want to play another track from Life on a String. This one's called Statue of Liberty.
Moon rises and sets in the real world. Islands and hurricanes. Wind blows in from Jersey. It floats across the bay into the open ocean. It's a good day to run away. Freedom is a scary thing. Not many people really want it.
You know, some of your music is so melancholic and in this song, you say you keep your distance, but you seem so intimate in this music.
Yeah, I think that's. I guess I was talking not so much about keeping my distance from people, but from big statements about things. You know, like when you write a song about freedom, it is a difficult thing to do because I think it's a very big concept, and we throw it around so easily, especially now, you know, and it really is a big issue in this country, what freedom means. Mm-hmm. And for artists, they would say, well, you know, like for me, I'm an artist because it's one of the few things that I could do where I'm totally free. Nobody can say, you know, do it this way or that way. I'm completely my own boss. But then I started thinking, wait a second, is that what freedom is really? I mean, that I can do whatever I want, whether it hurts people or not. And, you know, I look around at some artists who are, one guy was just showing me he was doing some, he's programming fish neurons to control a big mechanical arm that will make paintings.
Oh my God.
So, you know, as the boundaries between technology and biology get a little bit blurred, you have to start saying, do artists have a responsibility to say that they're not going to create harm? Or what kind of, do we have responsibilities like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, doctors have to sign something saying they will not hurt anyone. We also hold our government responsible for that as well. But they don't have to sign anything. They don't, you know, so.
Exactly.
Neither do scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Should they? I mean, should artists? Should anyone? You know, what does freedom actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's free to do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's been something that's puzzling me lately and thinking a lot about, and can't say that I've come up with an answer, because when you use the word free, you know, it starts getting kind of blurry what that means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can mean just an absence too, like, you know, you're free of prejudice, or a dog can be, you know, free of fleas. You know, I don't know.
You know, I think this is probably going to be your third piece in the trilogy.
Oh, maybe. You think so? I do like things that I don't know anything about and can't figure out. I'd love to tackle something that big.
Yeah, well, I would be fascinated to find out what you conclude if you did do that. In an interview, you said that you like it when audiences understand what you do because it makes you feel less lonely. Is that sense of loneliness what drives you to create, do you think?
Partly, I think, but also the other part is really just the fun of making something out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of like godlike thing to do, you know? It's like, wow, it wasn't there before, now it is. It's kind of very exciting, and it's a really big bonus if other people kind of get it. I think maybe you could create a great work of art and the only person who knows is you, like a painter, like locked up in a room.
Mm-hmm.
But I also like it, you know, I find that the art that I like is accessible in a way that, I mean, it's not really difficult. It can jump to other people pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I try to make as well, and I consider myself an average enough person so that it's not completely baffling to somebody else. Like, what does that mean? I have no idea what you're talking about. So that's kind of, that would be...
Yeah. Yeah, your music is definitely very accessible. It's poetry to me, so I applaud you for that. You have a couple projects going on in France. I don't know if they're still going on, but you have this walking project. Tell us about that.
Well, French Radio asked me to do a series, and I said that I would do an audio diary. And so I just recorded, you know, 10 minutes every day for like 6 months and put it together. I'm just finishing it now of music and some kind of commentary. But at the end I realized, you know, like writing like that every day is kind of like taking a walk because you really don't know what's going to come up. It's not like this has a plot or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of what happened. And or if your life does kind of have, if you do kind of know, then it's more like, you know, you plan every move and just live out your life. It was just, I guess some people do that, you know, they know where they're going to go to college and what they're going to do, and but anyway, mine is not very planned, and so I have no idea what's coming up, and I thought, that's an awful lot like, you know, walking, and just taking a walk when you don't know what's around the next bend. So with that in mind, I decided to finish the project by walking to Paris.
And wow.
At the time, I was in Milan, so, you know, a little problem with, like, the Alps. I decided to wait. And so it's a project I'm going to do this spring because I'm just completing it. And anyway, it's the other part of that plan was I was a little bit irritated at that point because President Bush was talking about the founding fathers of the United States and talking about them as men of God and country.
Mm-hmm.
Believers in God, and I thought, wait a second, no, they weren't. These are guys who were, wanted to separate church and state, actually, and they were men of the Enlightenment, and
mm-hmm.
they were reading Voltaire and Diderot, and so I thought, you know, in homage to this incredible idea of freedom that was concocted by the French and that Americans took with and totally ran with and, you know, designed a whole nother thing, that I would walk through France just in the sense of, you know, like a kind of homage. The problem is they don't really like us very much.
I know.
They don't like us at all.
I know, yep.
And so, and then I thought, well, you know, a nice little icebreaker. I have this really cute dog whose name is Lolabelle, sounds kind of French.
Uh-huh.
They French love dogs, so I thought, you know, I'll bring her and get some, like, little berets and baguettes, and, you know, we could just kind of come through and bonjour, you know, like a little more casual, but, you know, like we're just passing through, but not staying, don't worry, you know. So anyway, I think maybe I will have to take her on this walk to Paris when I do it this spring.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a colossal thing, this invention of, a very French invention of liberty. I mean, certainly not invention because a lot of people had done experiments with that over thousands of years, different ways of defining what it was. But we were very inspired by the French, and so I think that it's... And they were inspired by our revolution. People forget that it wasn't always the case that... There used to be, like, after the American Revolution, there were all of these, like, special toasts, like, 13, for the 13 states, you had to drink 13 glasses of wine, and they were, like, cooking all the French toast. And they also did a ballet dedicated to America, and with Quakers dancing in these, like, wool costumes, which seems, like, kind of impossible. Didn't want to see it. Ballet where the dancers were wearing wool. I don't know.
You know, you said you're moving from interest in technology and are finding more wonder in nature. Do you think that has to do with getting older?
Probably. But I do love gadgets, and I do really appreciate that I wouldn't be able to do this show 5 years ago. It would have taken a bunch of trucks. And now it can fit in my pocket. I'm running the whole thing off my laptop. And I don't have to carry keyboards around anymore. It's all software. They're soft synths, so it's just a bunch of numbers. So I hope I don't worship technology, but I really like it. It's making it easier to be portable. What I don't like about technology is it makes people sit at their desks, and it makes them kind of slaves to the economy of technology, meaning like you have to get your new iPod. And I mean, that is the biggest problem, I think, with it. It's like you have to keep getting all that stuff, and it can get quite exhausting and extremely expensive to be up to date with it. But I think with nature, being outside, I think it was just a reaction to the burnout of looking at screens all the time.
You're coming to Ithaca for the Light and Winter Festival. Were you captivated by the idea of science and art all gelling together?
Yeah, I find it extremely fascinating what those two things have to do with. And there really are, it's definitely a kind of worlds collide in certain ways situation. But I think it's really interesting when you try to get to know people who are doing something very radically different than you. Like, because you know you can think you really have a grasp of what the world is about, and then you realize, wow, you know what your little part of the world is about. But not necessarily. So one of the greatest things about this project for me was getting to meet people who I would not normally meet. I meet people who have to do with music and art, and in this case, I met a lot of nanotechnologists and people in robotics and all sorts of fantastic worlds that I really didn't know that much about. So that was great.
Well, we have run out of time. We're looking really forward to seeing you perform The End of the Moon on January 21st at Ithaca State Theater as part of the Light and Winter Festival. Thank you so much for being with us, Lori.
Very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.